Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 46. For those of you new to the show, my name's Simon Kane and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, TV and today, the live circuit. Daniel Sloss is a comedian who went pro before the age of 20, having started in comedy at the age of 16. I talked to him about certain career choices he made, including shunning some TV shows and what it was like to be put on TV at such a young age, as well as his thoughts on the worst show he's ever done and being pushed ahead of his peers into bigger and better sets and what that did to him internally and what it made him do in terms of his professionalism towards the industry. He's really interesting, he's really switched on, and I really enjoyed talking to him about this. We also got quite into the Dapper Laughs issue that happened a little while ago where he signed a petition that sort of said, I can't remember what the petition was specifically saying, but it was about how Dapper Laughs shouldn't be allowed to say some of the things he's saying, and we got into a little bit about censorship, about his TED talk, and about his opinions on whether he should or shouldn't have said that now. And it was quite humbling because he sort of apologised for it a little bit. So yeah, I won't say much more because I just want to get straight into this interview. If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to join the Facebook group. It is called Ask the Industry Podcast and it is on Facebook, of course. If you have a minute, please do leave me an honest review in iTunes. It really helps out in getting new and more exciting guests on, so that would be great. Also, there will be about 6 days when this podcast goes live that you can still pre-order my book. It's called How to Make a Living by Working for Free. It is £5 digitally. It is £8 paperback. And if you would like a copy, it would mean a lot to me and it would really, really help my dream of trying to get this book self-published out the door. So if you want to look in the show notes, click through. It's a how-to guide for artists and creators to build an audience around what they do using free content and then asking that audience to support them and to help them continue creating the things that they value and that the artist loves to do. In my case, that involves writing books and making podcasts. So if you would like to support me and you would like to buy my book and you think the book sounds interesting, that would be amazing if you would like to get a copy. If you don't want a copy, but you would like to gift it to someone else, do that. That'd be amazing. So thank you very much for listening to my pitch. Without any more delays, this is Daniel Sloss.
Elizabeth, like in the States, it's a little bit different. Like I'm going to New York and I've never been to New York before, so I'll probably go out and see that a little bit, and like, but I just don't get the point of tourism. Like, we were in Paris 2 years ago on tour, and Kai Humphreys, my supporter, was like, "Let's go see the Eiffel Tower," and I'm just like, just "Google it. Like, it looks exactly what you think it looks like."
Yeah.
Like, and if you go there, it's just gonna be filled with Parisians tutting. Like, I've got. Whereas with New York, I sort of feel like there's some bits of it I do want to see, but any of the tourism I want to do in New York is comedy based. Like, I want to go see Gotham, I want to go see the comedy clubs, I want to go see those sort of places, and I'll be there anyway. Hopefully, so yeah, I reckon I'll see a little bit. I'm not that bad of a tourist, but like some places, if it's like I was in Wisconsin and I was there for 5 days and I only went between the hotel and the comedy club because. For me, that's the fun part. You get on with the staff, you hang out with the staff afterwards, you get steaming drunk with them, and then you're hungover and you go find the closest food place, and then you just go, yeah. I'm sure there was lovely parts of Wisconsin and Madison, but it was also freezing.
Yeah.
Like, it was proper, like it was like January level of cold, and
right.
I was just like, nah, it's not worth seeing some buildings that I don't understand.
Yeah, no, I've done that before where I've been indoors and I've been like, I should probably live.
Yeah.
And then I looked out the window and gone, it's quite cold.
Yeah, it's absolutely freezing. I've been really hard to do that, yeah. I mean, for years with it, when I came down to London, I was born in London, but I didn't understand. I used to get the train from Piccadilly Circus to Leicester Square after the Comedy Store.
Right.
And before the bouncers were like, you know, that's 500 yards away from each other. And yeah. I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I was just used to get the train between them because I was an idiot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So London's a bit different. New York, I'll go see LA. LA's too big. Like, I go down to Santa Monica because it's just nice to sort of hang out. And then just, I go down there just on the off chance that I'll ever see Conor McGregor working out because he does a lot of training over there. And he's all his Instagram videos on with him training at the beat. And I love Conor McGregor.
Yeah.
He's a UFC fighter.
I've not, no.
Oh, I've got a picture of him as my background on my phone because I'm that much of a loser.
Conor McGregor. Fine.
He is an absolute god amongst men.
Well, all right. I'll be doing some Googling later.
Oh, absolutely. He's our generation's Muhammad Ali.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I'm aware of one quote from Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
The classic sting like a bee and fly like a
float like a butterfly sting like
a bee. I'm not even aware of it.
Yeah.
But
because he was. I didn't watch much Ali fights. I'm not really into boxing.
Right.
I just think it's such a lame way of doing it. Like, I'm into MMA because, you know, it's actual sort of fight and it's safer as well.
Yeah.
If you've got the boxing gloves on,
yeah.
It rattles your brain around, you can do permanent damage. So it's the same reason why American football is more dangerous than rugby, because your body's designed to be knocked out at certain points, not to have your brain rattle around in your head.
Right.
And boxing just seems like, it's like fighting, except you can't use anything else other than balloon fists.
Yeah.
I watched the Floyd Mayweather fight where there was Manny Pacquiao, and it was the dullest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Everyone was like,
yeah, but technically it's brilliant. I'm like, yeah, I wasn't watching it for the technical brilliance.
No, exactly.
I was watching it for violence.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's weird when someone gets like, I mean, I get like that with stand up where I'm like, I want to watch it for the technique or whatever.
Yeah.
But when it comes to boxing or ice hockey or something, I'm like, I just want to see them either knock each other over or push the puck or ball or whatever the thing is.
I want to see them do the thing as well as they can. I study stand up I watch the same specials over and over again. I must watch Bo Burnham's What about 7 times a year. Same with Bill Burr and Louis C.K. and just watch the nuances and like how they craft a joke and stay in the bits. Yeah, I think it's genius.
Yeah, totally. Now, let's stick with the young stuff for now. You were 17 when you started.
Yeah.
You did a comedy course, right?
I did a comedy course when I was 16, and then I did one gig when I was 16, but I don't consider that the start of my stand-up career because it wasn't a real comedy club. It was like 14 people in the audience, and if you ask any of them what I did that night, it was not comedy. It's just...
Right.
I prefer thinking my first gig is the Stand Comedy Club, 2007, September the 18th, or something like that, Red Raw. And so it was like a real comedy club. So I was like, nah, it's my first gig.
So you, because I've tried to book the Stand before, and they book that in advance.
Oh, yeah.
So how long ahead of time did you think, I'm going to book this, and why that club?
So I start, when I was about 16, I was very lucky to sort of hang out with Frankie Boyle, because he knew I sort of wanted to get into stand-up, and he sort of let me come to his show and sort of see how he wrote jokes, and then sent me off to meet like other comics like Andrew Maxwell and Glenn Wool and Craig Campbell and Adam Hills. So that was back in the 2017 festival. He put in a good word for me at the Stand and just went, there's a kid that wants to try stand-up. So I think they might have bumped me up the roster a little bit, and then a good couple of gigs. But I was, between the gigs, it was about a 2-3 month waiting list. Fortunately I was good, so that sort of helped speed up, and I was local, speed up the process, and it was nowhere near, like now I've got friends that are trying to get on Red Raw and they're just like, the waiting list is like a year, and it's mind blowing. So I think I got lucky before it got like as popular as it is now. So I managed to, I think I joined at the right time.
Okay. And yeah, because you wrote for Frankie Boyle for Mock the Week.
Yeah, something that's continuously taken out of context. Was everyone's just like, he wrote jokes for Frankie Boyle. Like, Frankie took me under his wing because he knew I wanted to do stand-up, and then as a sort of little writing technique, it was like, if you want, you can write some of the sort of bits for Mock the Week, and then he would sort of criticise how to write and to teach how to write to a deadline and stuff, and Like, he used one or two of the jokes, but there was absolutely no point in his career that he was sat backstage a month away being like, I can't go on, Daniel Sloss hasn't sent through his stuff. It was, I was not a valuable asset to him in any way, shape or form. He was just a very kind man who went above and beyond the call of duty to help out an aspiring stand-up comic.
And was there a reason why, I mean, was he helping other people or was he helping you?
My mum met him at a gig. He was doing a corporate gig for her company and she obviously knew I wanted to be a stand-up. So she just went, my son's got a couple of, would you mind answering some questions? And he was just like, sure, here's my email address. And then I emailed him and he was like, I'll be honest, I can't be bothered replying to this email. Why don't you just come and hang out with me? And I was just like, yeah, all right. So went to that and he was, yeah, great. And really, really, really... filled me with sort of confidence and just gave me a massive, massive boost in an already sort of competitive industry. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I suppose that helps quite early on, especially because at the time, probably quite young, didn't really like know the industry very well.
Didn't know what to do. And
didn't have management.
Yeah.
And so for someone who obviously you've seen on TV, I assume, and you know, seen
oh,
for
a
years.
Huge fan. Yeah. It was such a kind of wonderful thing. Yeah.
And how many gigs had you... So you'd gone to Edinburgh 2007?
2007 was... Yeah, so 2007 on that August... I mean, I go to the Fringe every year, but that was the month that I did the 2-day comedy course.
Right.
And then there was the gig at the... Just, like, near the end of the festival then. And then after that was when I did my first gig at the Stand.
Okay. So you didn't perform 2007?
Yes. It was just turned 17. So my birthday was on September the 11th, and I gigged 6 days after that.
Okay, and then you went back 2008 to do
the first show. No, for, was my first show in 2008?
Again, according to Wikipedia,
I did my first Fringe, but it was a double header show.
Yeah,
it was like me and another comic called Davey Connor did a half an hour show, 15 minutes each.
Mm.
And it was great. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Free Fringe, like 12:45 in the afternoon. Just had it. We only did like a week run, but it was absolutely rammed every day just because we got people on their lunch breaks. And yeah, it was great. Really loved it.
Yeah. And how was promoting that then? Because there's obviously in the Fringe, it shows at different times you different levels of well. And like you said, you probably got lunch break people, but I've done a show at 12:15 and I've had days where no one turned up, and then I've had days where I couldn't let everyone in.
We had such a unique selling point in the fact that it was a half an hour show.
Yeah, true.
It was free. It was right beside the room. It was at Espionage. So we were just like, it's over there. And it's in, you know, an hour. And also just been like, oh, I'm 17. And, you know, and Frankie'd said something nice about me. And was just like, you know, this kid. And I was like, oh, Frankie Ball's a fan. And this was back when Frankie was still on Mock the Week. So you just go, Frankie Ball's a fan of mine. People go, oh, well, we'll absolutely. Like, it's worth it. It's free and it's half an hour. Of course, we'll be there.
Yeah.
It was completely rammed every day. I mean, had to flyer, which is just the most soul-destroying thing. Haven't done it since. I did 1 week of flying, and I very much said I was like not doing that again.
Is that you haven't flied because you now are at a profile where your show sells out, or because you got flyers to do it for you?
I got flyers to do it for me.
Okay, right.
I hire people. Yeah, the year after I got my best friend Ali, because he flyered with me with the year we're doing Life in 2D, the double header. Ali flyered with me, and then the year after I was like, do you want to, I'll pay you if you fly for me. Just because it was such a It was just such a confidence knocker for me. I've got undying respect for those people that can and do it. And I know loads of people that are amazing at flyering their own shows. But straight away I was like, nah, fuck that. I'll pay the money to not have to do that.
Fair enough. Yeah. And I suppose, did that cause you to... Were you still doing Free Fringe by that point then?
No, first one in 2009 was my first one that was Teenage Kicks. That was at the Pleasance Dome.
Because obviously the big four cost a lot more than the Free Fringe to do.
Yeah.
And if you add in the cost of flyers and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, did that mean that... How did you do audience-wise for that? Let's do that first.
I have a very, very, very fucking good agent.
Okay. You had an agent by 2009?
Yeah. She did Life in 2D and the doubleheader show with Davey Connor. And just through a mixture of things, my agent had heard of me through several things. One, the So You Think You're Funny final, which I was in 2008. Yeah. So she'd heard of me through Julia Chamberlain, who was, as ever since then, has just been the kindest, most supportive woman. So my agent heard of me through her, and then I gigged with Jim Owen, who she's also the agent of. Jim Owen saw me, loved me, and then I randomly flyered the husband of one of her oldest friends who works in PR. And so she heard from 3 points, like, there's this 17-year-old kid that you should probably look at, and then met up with her. signed with her. She sent me on a 5-day tour with Jamon. And then she was like, you should probably still go to university. My mum was like, don't go to university. Take a year off. Take a gap year before you go to university. Some people go out and find themselves. Why don't you just stay and work on stand-up? And if you can always just go back next year. And the month before I was due to go to university, I did my first run at the Edinburgh Festival. And it was sold out every day because my agent is exceptional at what she does.
Okay. So there's a load of stuff in that I wanted to go through. So 2008, I know you went to The Fringe and you were doing that split show.
Yeah, So You Think You're Funny.
And you were the youngest finalist for that.
Yes,
at the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, that's a unique selling point as it is, which you'll kind of grab.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's not at the end of The Fringe, isn't it? So
yeah, so the semi-finals is like halfway through. I think I did the semi-final like the 13th.
Yeah.
And then the finals like on the 27th or something like that.
So did being in that actually help you? So like when you were, because obviously you can't just update your flyers on the last weekend and say I am the finalist or whatever.
We put on semi-finalist on the flyers,
right?
And then my run was done before I became a finalist. I think. Yeah.
Okay, so your run selling out was pretty much through your flyering.
Just through flyering. Yeah.
Okay, which you didn't like.
No, which I didn't like, but we were good at.
Okay. And then you got an agent at the end of Edinburgh that year?
Yeah, pretty much. We didn't sign anything. I've not signed a contract with my agent. It's purely based on trust.
Oh, so you've never signed a contract?
Never signed a contract with her, never will. But I will never in my life leave her. Like, this is... Yeah, no.
That's really interesting. Because, so how does that work?
She got me a house.
She what?
She got me a house.
Okay. I'm not saying oh, what's happening there? Yeah. It's just a really interesting thing that
trust. Like her whole thing, she was like, look, I'm going to work my ass off for you. And it's purely trust. And she has, everything I have, I put some of it down to myself, but I put a lot of it down to her. Like the success I have would not have if it was not her. I reckon I could have gone with a bunch of other agencies and I would not be where I am today if it was not for my current agent.
Who's your agent?
Marlene Zwickler.
Okay, and that's MZA, is
it? MZA, yeah. So she's me, Jamon, Kai Humphries, Craig Hill, Mark Nelson, Mickey Bartlett, and she's got a new one, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name. So
how many gigs would you say you'd done by the time you'd gone to Edinburgh 2008?
It must have been about 40.
40.
40 or 50.
So between 2007... the stand gig,
yep.
And going to Edinburgh and doing a 15-minute spot.
Yeah.
You've done 40 gigs.
I think so.
And then obviously got to the final of an amazing competition.
Yeah.
And then picked up an agent.
Yeah.
Did you ever at any point, and this is with all due respect, think, wow, this is too quick?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, still do.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm still very aware.
Right.
My whole career has been shitting myself of when is this gonna end? Like this has to peter out at some point. But thankfully, the way my agent sort of worked with me, when I was 17, I never in my fucking wildest dreams thought I was actually gonna be like a working comic making a living, and gigging and getting to travel the world. So and I now am, which is why I don't have any further ambitions. I've always said anything from here on in is a bonus.
Right.
Like, I am literally living my dream job. I never thought I'd be at the stage. I am, I think, hundreds and thousands of people go through their life never achieving their dream. And the fact that I have to then have another one is just such a fucking arrogant way. I want to do more. Why? I'm so happy where I am.
Okay. So you're sort of, I don't want to say complacent, but you're perfectly content at the moment.
If my career doesn't go any further than this, and if it stays where it is, die happy, man. Don't get me wrong, I'd love to do more. I'd love to get to the stage where selling out theatre tours. I'd love to be able to like tour America. I'd love to.
But that comes down to you doing more stand up.
That's
not really doing anything different than what you're doing now, except for the bigger crowds.
I just want to be the best. I just want to be the best stand up in the world.
Okay.
And the way to do that is by, just doing what I'm doing, which is gigging as much as I can, doing The Fringe every year, touring every year.
Yeah.
Just enjoying it.
See, that strikes me as interesting because I've been watching Muff, the sitcom that you've been writing with David stayed. Yeah, and obviously I've been watching Crowdsource, that kind of thing, and obviously you're going to America tomorrow, is it?
Or Monday. Yeah,
Monday. And you've Conan, you've just done that for the fourth time and stuff. So
I'm doing it for the fifth time on Tuesday. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. So from an outsider's point of view, you look a lot more driven than you sound like you might be at the moment to get something additional to what you have now.
Oh yeah. Like, yeah, kind of. I mean, with Muff, there was no. Muff was just a fuck you to everyone. Like, that's why. Yeah, Muff was. Yeah, it was just because we were just sick of being like, oh, you got to get something made. You've got to do it this way, and we were just like, why?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sick of people high up in the BBC who have never stepped foot in a comedy club in 7 years. Going up to young talent and telling them what's funny. You don't have the right to tell a comedian what's funny. Don't get me, BBC have produced some amazing shows. They're some of my favourite comedy shows have been on the BBC, but some of them are utter fucking shite. And I've seen so many good comics have shows that are not as good as they could be, and it's never the comedian's fault. It's someone who's not been in a comedy club, who doesn't understand comedy, who bases humour on the ratings that it gets and the viewership, which I understand exactly. That's their job.
Their model,
I absolutely understand that. Mm. But so and that, it makes sense to me, but we didn't want to do that. We were like, we want to make something that makes us laugh. Mm. And I don't want someone coming in being like, is that funny? And we're just like, well, we all laughed. So yes. Yeah, no, it is. We all laughed.
Yeah.
So Muff was just, and also we just wanted to see if we could. Like, yeah. It was really like, because you know, it's all film. I was sitting there, you know, snidely bitching about, oh, you know, all these production companies, and you know, they're like, how dare you tell us what's funny? And all the, and then we're like, oh god, maybe we, like, it's all fine and well just sitting there moaning, but let's see if we actually can. Mm. And we just managed it.
Yeah.
we did not raise anywhere near the money that we thought we needed. And yeah, I mean, at points we were sitting there and being like, oh god, this would have been good if we did have someone on this job that knew what they were doing. Like, we understand.
Yeah.
But then we did do it. And I would argue tooth and nail with anyone that Muff visually, like the way it was filmed, thanks to Troy Edige, our cameraman, and thing. I would argue that it is as good as most of the stuff on BBC. It's not groundbreaking. It's not exceptional. It's got holes, plot holes in it that are massive. It's deeply flawed, but it was our first ever thing. We filmed like 6 episodes in 20 days with like £6,000 and 10 crew members, and we'd never done anything like it before. Only in the past 2 months have I become proud of Muff. Before, I was absolutely terrified.
Right.
Because it was such a, could we really put ourselves out there? Because we were like, fuck the system.
Then we're
like, oh god, maybe we shouldn't have said fuck the system. Maybe we should have a bit more respect for the system, because this is way harder than we thought it would.
Maybe we shouldn't have left before the system woke up.
But the way Muff's gone, I mean, don't get me wrong, I would love to do stuff on television. I've got a deal with Warner Brothers and Conoco and stuff, and I'm fully aware that that is going to be the same sort of system where you go through pitching and then people get involved. I, you know, would love to do stuff, because there is so many things to learn through the process, and you know, but I'm definitely going to do more stuff that, like, just online content, just stuff that I film with the same guys I filmed Muff with, and other ideas, just because it was just so much fun. It was fun all the way through. It was just a bunch of friends making something to just, like, it's like when camera phones came out when you were like 15 and you were all just making stupid little videos. It was just like that, but with like a professional crew.
Yeah,
it was great.
It's like, you mentioned Louis C.K. earlier. Yeah. It was like, I've seen him in an interview where he said that, because he directs, edits, writes, starts, you know, all that stuff in his sitcom.
Yeah.
And he said, like, I wouldn't have been able to do it if I hadn't have, like, gone through, you know, classes and learned all the, how lenses work and everything. And I'm like, well, would you now? Because you can go on YouTube and look up how stuff works and, you know, where lenses cut off and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I've literally on Tuesday, I just recorded my DVD on my own. And, you know, like I got the venue and I got the camera crew together. I did everything. Yeah. It was great. And it felt amazing. It was like, oh, I don't have to wait to get permission. I can just do it. I mean, I don't know how many people will buy it, but I can.
That's exactly what. Just do it. Quoting Nike for no reason. I think the way is what people need to do more. Like, I mean, with all these TV companies that make these shows, there is absolutely a place for them. And, you know, the stuff they do, and they've made some excellent stuff. But then again, but what I think they do a lot of the time is they make you think that that's the only way for it to be done.
They have to.
Yeah.
In some ways. Because if we all realised, I mean, I just, the last interview that went out was with Ian Coyle, who is the Dave Comedy Commissioner.
Yeah.
And in it, I was talking to him about how they commission something, like what's their criteria. And he said, well, I'm not really a commissioner, I'm an ad man. Like, someone comes to me with an idea and says, oh, it's got Frankie Boyle in it or whatever, I can go to advertising and say, we know Frankie Boyle will bring in X number of viewers because he's got a consistent track record. Essentially, we can sell an advert in the middle. Let's commission it.
Yeah.
And so he was like, I thought it was going to be great. Now I'm in my job and I'm like, actually, this is not the job I thought I was going to get.
Yeah.
And it's a weird one. I've got Shane Allen coming on to him, the BBC Comedy Commissioner, and I'm interested to see, because they don't really have advertising on, well, they don't have advertising on this. So although they have stakeholders and people to agree with, it's sort of going to be interesting to find out how they... Because, like you mentioned, the BBC, I just thought it was just an interesting...
I've worked with the BBC before, and there's lots of people...
You did The Adventures of Daniel.
Yeah, which is a perfect example of one of the reasons why I don't have respect for certain parts of it. Like, The Adventures of Daniel was never the idea that came out. I had a lot of... Everyone that worked on that show worked their fucking ass off, like Gemma Rogers and all the crew, and Tim Alsop and Stuart, and the writers were amazing, but it was... They all worked within the confines of the people that were never involved in the show set them. We were like, oh, we want to make a show about a young stand-up, you know, comedian, just sort of life on the road. And they were like, oh, well, what if it's about him and his girlfriend? And we were like, no.
That's
not. And they were like, no, but we think that's great. And we're like, and Tim and the bro, we're just sitting and we're like, this isn't the idea we came up with, but... It was very much do what we say or you don't get it. And we were just like, all right, well, let's go. You clearly know what you're talking about. Mm. And they
didn't even commission it.
No. Which I'm not that. Now in hindsight, I'm glad. I think it might have sent me down a different path comedy-wise than I've gone down now. Mm. It sort of allowed me to sort of... If Adventures is Daniel had gone successful... Fear maybe I would have gone mainstream, and
right. Are you avoiding that?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I like comedy with substance.
And you think how would you define a mainstream comic then? Maybe with a given example if you want. But
Peter Kay.
Yeah.
Okay. And don't get me wrong, I've got absolute respect. I think he's, stagecraft wise, but he's never said anything in his life.
Right,
like, and it's funny. It's funny. Look,
you can be funny, but not say anything.
Yeah. And I've got absolute respect for that. Like, look, I'm never going to criticize Peter Kay. The man sells out tours. He's one of the biggest comics in this country. Mm. People love him. He reduces people to tears. It's not my sort of comedy.
Yeah.
I'll watch and I'll laugh, but I prefer, you know, the likes of Louis C.K. and Bill Burr and Carlin and Jim Jefferies and Tim Minchin and Bo Burnham and Tig Notaro and Maria Bamford and Mike Birbiglia, all these comics with substance.
Would you not? So, if we took Louis C.K., Bill Burr, and Tim Minchin, or whatever, at what point would you? I mean, would you? I would say that they are mainstream now.
Oh no, I absolutely wouldn't.
Would you define mainstream? Then?
Go ask anyone in the street right now who's Louis C.K. is.
Oh, that's how you're defining. Okay, because I'm defining it as in comedy, size
absolutely.
Of audience.
Yeah, fine. If we're talking in comedy, Louis C.K. Right. Bill Burr. Mentioned they're all.
Oh yeah, I mentioned Louis to my dad the other day.
No idea.
He had no idea. No idea. And then I said McIntyre, and he went, "Oh, I know who that is."
Of course.
And I was like, "How do you know who that is?" But not in an offensive way to McIntyre, because he's an easy target, and he's always used as a target.
And he shouldn't be. McIntyre's work ethic is sublime, and he's a great comic.
But I'm sure let's do Peter Kay then. I'm sure if I mention Peter Kay to my dad, he'd
absolutely.
Know, right? My problem with that is I'm probably with you on this. I like substance in my comedy. I like someone who goes up on stage and makes me laugh, and then I go away and later on I'm like thinking. Yeah, no, not maybe at the time, but later on I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And it's kind of, in fact, that was, I was going to ask you about this, but we're talking about it kind of now. Your TED talk, I remember you did.
No, no, you can't. I was 22. I was so nervous. It was such a tiny crowd. I wish I could have done it in a thousand different ways, looking back on it. But I guess that's what hindsight is.
Yes. I always, I've in therapy, I'm trying not to do this now,
yeah.
But every time I look back at myself a year ago, I go, you were a fucking idiot. And she's trying to teach me not to do that, because apparently that's really damaging. But I always think if you don't do that, you've not been trying hard enough to improve.
Yeah, yeah, I do. If I don't hate myself 2 years ago,
oh yeah,
I've not improved.
Yeah, that's what I think. But you're meant to at least look at it in a positive way of your improvement, not you were a wanker.
No, absolutely. No, I fundamentally disagree with that. Yeah, no. Okay. Maybe in 10 years' time, I'll look.
Oh, no, I did it like a month later. I'm like, did I say that to her? Oh, God.
Yeah. But 10 years' time, I think it's enough time for me to be like, that was a different guy. 2 years ago, I'm like, oh, God, I remember those thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I remember.
I remember
it's
that feeling.
Too close.
Because I remember, because in your TED talk, you were talking about how a story is just a story, and a joke's just a joke, and therefore, you know, we as comedians shouldn't be judged or censored in the same way, in the way that we are getting censored in some ways. And do you think that's got worse since you've done that TED talk?
No, we're not being. It's nice for us to think that we're being censored. We're not. Like, when has anything been? Yeah, okay, the BBC might not put certain things out, but that's because they'll get complaints. They'll get Ofcom. There are sad losers out there who go out their way to get offended by things because it makes them feel alive and important. And I think being offended by something is the most self-involved, narcissistic thing a human being is capable of. To go and watch a comedy show with anywhere between 80 and 3,000 other people in the room, and for that comedian to say something, and for you to be upset. I'm like, oh, that was about me. No, it wasn't. This is a tour. Like, this kid, like, do we have anybody, something like Bill Burr says when he's doing a tour to 100,000 people, and for you to be like, oh, that was aimed at me. Oh, fuck off.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But they're not being, people might not come. People, the reason people think we're being censored is just because now, thanks to the internet, everyone's got an opinion and they'll hear it. And sometimes it does feel like, oh, you said I can't say this. Who has ever been physically arrested on stage in this country or America?
No. Like, I can't think of anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even close, like, oh yeah, there's the loud rally cries of all this sort of stuff. But, yeah, no, it's never really sort of, the only time it's censorship is, you know, if you are trying to make something that goes on to television, and that's not really censorship, really.
Yeah.
It's not, oh, you can't say that because of this. It's just like, you can't say can't because it's BBC.
Yeah, you're going, so like you said, if I record a video and put it up online, I can say anything. I can go, oh, I hate children, or I can say any, I can't think of anything more offensive than that right now, but I can say something really horrible, and because it's my platform, I can do that. It's like Katie Hopkins, if she wants to tweet something, she can say that, and you have to sort of go, well, I don't necessarily agree with it, but that's her platform. Whereas if she goes on ITV or Good Morning or whatever,
and then says this thing, and then you go,
I hate immigrants or something, you're on their platform, she shouldn't be able to say it there and stuff. I remember because there was that thing with Dapper Laughs a while ago, and I think, didn't you sign a
petition? Which I regret massively.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I absolutely should not have signed that.
Why not?
Well, I disagree with what you said. I got caught up in the hype. I still don't agree with a lot of the things he said, but I had no right to stop him from saying things.
Right.
I massively regret that.
Do you think he was treated correctly or badly?
I think it was one of the problems. Like, it was very hard, and you know, I was absolutely just swept away by the rage machine. Like, it was 2 years ago, I got caught up in the hype, and I was like, oh, I've got an opinion on this too, because you know, I didn't agree with some of the things he said, and I thought, but then I just, it was so hypocritical. I don't watch it. Why did I follow him? Why did I go out of my way to watch the videos that I knew were going to... It was pathetic of me, yeah. Now, with the ITV thing, it was an interesting art. Everyone thinks it's black and white. He was wrong. He was this... No. He was saying some things that we disagreed with, and the problem was, even if he didn't mean them, which I don't think he necessarily meant the things, some of the things he said, I think he was caught up in the wave of his fans, that fan base that came up, the fans that, if he was being ironic, which nobody apart from him knows whether it was a character really or what his intent behind it was, but he starts getting positive feedback from doing this thing. He starts doing it a bit more. He goes a bit too far, and then the left get outraged. Mm. But then he's got so many people saying, yeah, this is great. And then so many people saying, this is awful. And I think he was just reacting. I still don't agree with anything he said, but I don't... I should not have joined in that witch hunt, personally, me. Okay. It was very hypocritical of me.
Yeah, I could see why that'd be hypocritical.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wasn't trying to imply that.
It's something I've ever since then. Kai Humphries absolutely called me out of it in an argument that we were having, and I just went, "Oh fuck it, you're right. I was wrong."
Yeah, I mean, I got involved in it briefly, and all I basically said was, "I think comedy can have change. It can have an impact on people's opinions on things, and it can definitely." Like we said before, you know, can make people think, and it can make you at least think about your opinions or think about how your actions, or if you look at like the in-betweeners or, you know, something like that, where bus wankers became like a thing people were shouting for a while, or clunge was like a regular phrase and stuff.
Yeah.
And at the time when he was a lot bigger than he is, I mean, he's still big, but you know, if you searched for, you know, like women getting yelled at moist and things like this, that was happening.
And
for me, that was like, I was like, he, even if he doesn't think that that is something that's happening, it is.
Yeah.
And I think to not acknowledge that you're having an impact in this way
was
wrong.
Yeah.
I wouldn't stop him saying anything. I don't think it's fair for me to get involved in that.
Yeah.
But I do think, I didn't know whether he was self-aware enough to know that that was something that was...
Yeah, I agree. Like, you know, I don't doubt that it did have a negative sort of thing on a lot of people. And obviously, because I'm not a woman, I'm not getting any of this... you know, that sort of things, you know, I was never going to be the victim of any of it, so that's also why my opinion on this subject doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I have that moment as well. If I ever do a joke anywhere near feminism or anything like that, I sometimes think to myself, I still need to write it as a guy, because I've never been catcalled, or I've never been sent a dick pic, or I've never, you know what I mean, so, or an unsolicited dick pic even.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, so as a result, if I...
So you've been sent solicited dick pics?
I've been loads. Feel free to tweet me. Actually, I don't want to do it. I've been encouraging interactive bits of this podcast. The last thing I want is a couple of thousand comedians sending me their dick pics. But feel free to send them to Daniel. I mean, I'm sure he'd...
By all means.
He'll retweet you.
Yeah.
You know what's going to happen? We're going to have, like, as in cock pictures of animals, not penises.
Oh, yeah,
just being sent to us.
Which is
perfectly reasonable. I just wondered what you thought of, because of the whole... Because I rewatched your TED talk about censorship and...
Yeah, which is, again, why it was absolutely so hypocritical of me to get involved in the DAPR thing anyway.
But, I mean, I've never seen it, but I'm assuming at some point you've been sent feedback on Twitter or Facebook.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I mean, what do you do with critic? I mean, how do you deal with... Because you tour to much more people than I do.
Mm.
So statistically, more people are going to hate you in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
And as a result, you're going to get more hate leveraged your way. How do you deal with hate like that?
Work out whether I respect the person, and if I don't respect the person, I don't respect the opinion.
So if it's just a random person that came to see you,
I've had jokes that I look back on, and someone called me on them, and I'm like, oh fuck yeah, no, I guess you're absolutely right. Like, I used to have fat shaming jokes, and someone called me out on it, and I went, you're right. And I did, and you know, I don't do them anymore. I learned from that, but then again, I've had people complain about the... So Russell Howard's set gets shown every now and again on like Comedy Central, and I've got a bit in there where it's about, I call it my promosexual material, because it's pro-gay rights and stuff like that, because I'm obviously liberal and I jump on the bandwagon. And some guy just came in and was, gay guy was like, oh, this was actually really offensive what you said about us. And although his argument was, you know, I said I was stereotyping gays, which, looking back on it, I probably was, but it was in a positive way, and the whole intent of the bit was, you know, it was meant to be good, and it was a lot of comedy's generalizations. Right? Yeah, I could have explained that obviously not all gay people are like that way, that would be ridiculous, but then that creates a 45-minute explanation before I get to the punchline. And just where I was like, listen to the intent of the joke. Like, okay, I understand, and I will now be more conscious of it, but it was 5 years ago. Like, what do you want me to do?
You were 2020.
I think it was 20 or 21, yeah. Like, what? Yeah, I was ignorant. I still am. There's going to be things I say in this year's show that in 5 years' time I'm going to look back and be like, oh, that was a stupid thing to think.
Do you... I'm going to try and phrase this as nicely as I can.
Oh, please, feel free.
Because I'm trying to work out whether this... Cause I don't want to insult you at all, because, you know, you've given up your time.
Can't be insulted.
No, I know. Well, you can neglect it on Twitter, but in real life, it might be much more harsh. Okay, so... I mean, I'm quite young still as well. And if I do a joke... You know, I used to do a joke about how... Some people say they stalked me online, which I think really undermines the good, hard-working stalkers who follow me. You know, that guy, it's just a play on words. It's just a silly thing. And I do that same kind of joke for stalking, and then for, I can't remember, old grammar Nazis, and then for fraping. And then I never finish the last one. I just go, you all know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And it kind of does that. And I look back on it, and I think, I feel like I made a good enough point. I feel like I was succinct enough that I'm clearly on the side of victims in that, and I'm not trying to do that. Mm. However, I do think maybe I was a bit, like, childish to sort of think that I could, and me, because I was 25 or 4 when I was working on that joke, maybe I'm thinking that's quite ahead of me, mm-hmm. as it were. And do you ever have like that when you think, if I'm tackling like a certain subject, you're like, will people take me seriously because of my age or because of who I am? Or
age, I don't have a problem with anymore, because I've been doing this for 8 years now. I've earned my place on the circuit, so I think I've got those years where I felt out of place in green rooms, like just sort of young. I was given a lot of TV breaks at a very young age because I was young, because I was arguably attractive, because I was a box ticker. I was something outside the norm, and I was given television spots that we can all agree there are several other comics on the circuit probably deserve more who were funnier than I was, but they didn't have the unique selling point. And because I was so conscious of that and so worried about it, that made me work my ass off to make sure. Like, I was like, no, I need to belong in this green room.
Yep.
That I need to make sure it's not questioned. Like, I and it might be a shallow thing, I want the respect of my peers because they're my peers and I respect them.
I don't think that's shallow.
Like, I want one of my favourite moments of the 2016 was in Altitude. And Jim Jeffries was there, and I was there with my mum and my dad. And I gigged with Jim a couple of years ago. I hung out with him in LA, and I was a fan of Jim before I started stand-up. Mm. And I was just sitting talking to my dad, and Jeffries came over and started talking to me. And it was just a really cool moment where my dad was just standing there and watching a comedian that we went to see live together when I was 14 talking to me as a peer. Like, he wasn't talking to me to be nice. He wasn't talking to me. And I was just like, oh, this is...
The-. Inside you were like...
Ah. I was like, this
on
is...
On the outside, I'm like, hey,
I was just like, oh, hey, Jim. Hey, Jim. I was like, Jeffries.
Can I call you Jim?
Yeah.
I think I've seen you.
I forgot the original question, so I completely ran
it. It was just an interesting point that you made where you were saying that you look back on material maybe a little while ago and sort of say, I mean, what would you say is the worst show you've done in terms of, so let me validate that, in terms of maybe the learning process of making it, or in terms of the material that you look back on and you think, maybe there was just one bit in it that I feel like now I would never do?
Good question. I don't know if it was the worst show. I think the most difficult show I had was my fourth one. So my first 2 years I was at the Pleasance. Third year I was at the Spiegel Tent Assembly. And then I went over to the EICC, where I've been ever since, and I will be forever, until they name that room after me. But that was because that was the year that I changed my tone. Like, that was the year when I, you know, started turning down certain TV shows because I didn't want to be a panelist. I didn't want to be, a comedian. And it's, for me personally, it was very hard to be a comedian on a panel show.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm not a one-liner comic. I'm not a topical comic. I don't do political stuff, and that's why I sort of think American stand-ups. I think that's why all the great stand-ups, most of them are American, and it's because in America they go, "You're a stand-up. Come on this show and do stand-up." There's like five or six late night spots every week, and it's like, "You're a stand-up. Come do stand-up. You're a stand-up." Over here, you're a stand-up. Present this.
Go do a panel show. Yeah.
You're a stand-up. Be on a panel show. You're a stand-up. Be honest. And for the comics that are able to do it, it blows my mind. I mean, you want to talk about great comics, the Neil panel shows, you've got Sean Logg, you've got Catherine Ryan, crushes it, whatever panel show she's, and I've got so much respect, and I just watched, been like, I couldn't do that. I mean, I could have done it had I practiced and really tried, but it would have been taking me away from the stand-up that I wanted to do. So I started turning down TV. I didn't want to be famous for the sake of being famous. I wanted to do comedy with what I thought was more substance. And the first time I was at the EICC, I think, and I was still getting the audience that had seen me on McIntyre's Roadshow and Russell Howard's and the Rob Brydon Show and all that sort of stuff, and the 10 Cats, they were coming. And then I was doing comedy about how there's no God. I was doing jokes about drugs. I was doing jokes about, you know, death and darker sort of subjects. And every day I watched at least 10 people walk out the show. And that was really hard because
you weren't consciously trying to shake off an audience. You were trying to refine them into
not consciously shaking them off, but every day I did that struggle of just like just do cleaner stuff. Just when you see them leaving, I was just like, and I really had to just go no. Say what you want to say, and you have to shake these people off.
Was that the year that, because I remember there was a year you had some shows and you had late shows.
Oh, I do that every year.
Oh, okay, sorry. I thought it might have been you were doing late shows with slightly darker material.
Oh, no, that was just a very, very clever marketing campaign on my agent's side. We did the early shows and late shows, and the later show was slightly darker. Wasn't darker. There was no more swearing. It was the exact same show, but you put on two separate shows, you get to be in the Fringe brochure twice.
Yeah, I tried that. I had an idea 2014. I was going to call it Deja Vu, and I tried to get it listed twice because I thought it would be great if like it was just the same, except for the second listing just said something like, why are you still reading this? You just read it above, or something like that, in like a cocky, weird way. And then the Fringe brochure people, they were like, yeah, you can't list it twice because it's the same show.
Yeah,
and I was like, but I still want to pay to list it. Can I pay to list it twice? I'm more than willing to pay.
I don't know how my agent did it, but she did it.
Well, it's a different title, that's why.
That's why.
But I wanted it to be, because of the Deja Vu element, I wanted it to be identical.
I mean, I probably did swear a little bit more, because it was a later show, and obviously, you know, the first show was at 7:30, and then the second was at, like, 9:30, so I'm just like, I can probably say cunt a bit more during this.
Yeah.
And the audience, you know, the audience that had come specifically to see there, so maybe I apologised a bit less for material, I went a little bit harsher, and I was probably a bit drunker for them. Mm. But yeah, that year, that was a tough year, and I didn't really enjoy the show that year. But then the year after that was the show. I think that show was called The Show. And then I did stand up, and then I did Really, and then I did Dark. And those past three shows I've done have been, I'm so, so proud of them. That was the time when I was like, oh, and I've not found my voice fully yet. It's a constant ongoing thing because you change, and it's you're never done. But I was like, oh, I'm in the right lane now. Like, I'm now going down those bits I was writing that I was really happy with. Like, I had a joke last year's show and this year's show about tampons. And I really enjoyed it. And it was kind of about the luxury tax in a bit. But it wasn't really. It was just about how I didn't understand why tampons weren't free. Mm. Like, the whole bit was like, we live in a country with free healthcare. How is that not healthcare? You're bleeding.
Yeah.
Sounds medical.
Yeah.
And it was a 20-minute bit. And I loved it. I was like, oh, this is like a really, really good bit. And then I did a joke about death and you know, I really enjoyed it. It's just sort of saying stuff, because to kind of go back to the Dapper thing is that I, about 3 years ago, began to realize how important some material actually was. It has a lot more effect than you think. I got a tweet from a 14-year-old kid in America telling me that after watching my stand-up, he had the courage to come out to his parents. And you just go, what?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
You don't have a clue sometimes.
No idea. And I was just like, that's huge.
Yeah.
And that was, so if I've done that unconsciously, and that was a great feeling. I had a girl come to my show about 3 years ago. Her dad was there. She said, my daughter's got a question. And she went, you always talk about, you know, being pro-gay rights. How do you feel about lesbians? And it was so weird. But then I realized in my stand-up, whenever I was talking about gay rights, I was always very specifically making it men.
Right.
Right. Just not consciously, but then realized that from her perspective, like, yeah, I'm a stand-up that she likes, and I'm on stage doing all this stuff, but I was making it all about men, and it was not intended. I obviously meant gay rights all across the board, but after that, I was very conscious to make sure that it was sort of, I mentioned both of the terms were gender neutral or whatever, and that's when I got just seeing those two moments, which were very nice.
Yeah.
Like, made me very worried about God. What about if some kid loved me, or any audience member? And then I just joke about fat people, and this was like a body conscious kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I took that response. I just maybe don't think maybe Dapper didn't think about that. But then again, why would he have? Because he wasn't getting the same fan base, and he probably wasn't
getting that level of feedback either.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But for me, I became a bit more conscious of making sure, just going, who's the victim in this joke?
Yes.
Let's make sure it's always me or victims that I can justify.
Yes. Yes, I completely agree with that. Because that, I see a lot of newer comedians, especially if I'm going to do, like, I don't know, headline spot somewhere on an open mic thing or whatever, and you watch them do something and you're like, do you know that you're the high status in this, or you're the one who... it's a bit like it's fine if you do like a joke where later on, like, it's like sort of, oh, this person said it to me and then I had this witty comeback and whatever, and then you're like, oh, in reality I waited 3 hours to come up with that you know, it's fine when you're like that, but when you're actively trying to become the higher status than someone else in a joke, sometimes I think you need to be aware that you are basically putting down some other group.
I think a lot of young comics, not a lot, it's incorrect,
it's called newer comics,
newer comics watch comedians like Stanhope and Jeffries, and they're like, oh God, you know, I could do jokes, but suicide jokes are funny, and you go, no, you've not watched the bit.
Yeah.
Stanhope's bit about suicide is never making fun of suicide victims.
No.
Right? It's talking about suicide, but it's the outrage culture. Some people hear the word rape and they just go offended.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, you want to talk about Brendan Burns, 1 year went out of his way to try and come up with a rape joke that rape victims found funny. And he did. But then other amateur comics, newer comics, I think probably watched that and went, rape jokes are funny. I've seen Ben Burns did a rape joke.
Yeah.
And then he went out and just did a horrible rape joke. And you just go, no, you've missed the point of the...
And then the media picks up on that and goes, oh, there's an epidemic of rape that's going on. Yeah. And look at them taking the mick out of this group of people. And you're like, no, it's just, you've gone to the wrong gig.
I mean, I would never do... a rape joke, but not for any moral reasons. It's just I'm not a good enough comic to do it yet. I don't know enough. Any joke I would do about it would very, very likely be ignorant and upset people. And
yeah, I think, because that's the interesting thing, because like sometimes you're not you specifically, but sometimes a comedian's joke is deliberately ignorant just because it's funny that you would think something like that. But I think there's a line between you taking the angle of, I'm just saying something ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's a bit like Louis's joke, for example, where he goes, you should never rape anybody unless you want to be in their body and they don't let you. Like, it's such a stupid thing to say. And it's so far beyond, like, it's clearly he's being ignorant and flippant about it.
That even
friends of mine that are sort of a bit like, that's bad. You've seen them have a wry smile about it because it's so mad.
Because the joke there is he's the idiot.
Yes.
Like, I've got a joke in last year, so I talked about how I had a gay drug dealer, and I basically, and it was true. The way I used to wind David up my gay friend, was just because we're friends, I would just the whole time just pretend that I thought, whenever I was, and I still do it with like other gay friends very casually, but I just pretend that I think being gay is a choice. It makes me laugh. I'm just like, so I just said, I'm like, so when did you choose to be gay?
Yeah.
And they're like, shut up. And I'm like, no, but like, when did you
make that choice?
Yeah, when did you make the switch? Yeah. Was it like you filling out a form and it said straight and you went, oh, maybe it's just this
year.
Maybe
I'll just give it a go.
And the reason it's because it's so obviously.
Yeah.
And I obviously don't think that's the thing. No. That I say the most horrific things to my flatmate Jean, right? Just about, I'm just like, I should just do something stupid. And I'll be like, and to think we gave you the vote. Because it's so obviously not what I think. But then other people will, idiots, will, and that's what people, they take comedy literally. Yeah. They just go, you said it, you meant it. I've got a line in my show where I'm like, my mum went to one of those pregnancy classes where women can go along and practice overreacting.
Yeah.
But I obviously, but and so, but
no,
no,
I get that.
But it's so obvious that I'm the idiot in the joke.
Yeah. No, I get that. I sometimes do that to friends of mine where, like, say someone does something just so stupid, I'll just sort of go, "And we gave you the fact," or something, just because it's like it's reflecting that they've done something stupid. It's and it's clearly me just meeting them.
And the victim of that joke is homophobes.
Yeah,
you're like, how stupid is it that people think this?
Yeah.
Like, how dumb would you have to be? You're making fun of like, oh, look at me, I think it's, that's, for me at least, I think. But then again, I'm not a gay man, so maybe I don't know.
Yeah, I have a problem in that I'm working on a joke about gay marriage rights at the moment. Yeah. And I wrote it and I thought, this is quite good. And I sent it to a gay friend of mine. And I thought, hang on, am I? You know, like on TV when they do say a woman does a joke or a man does a joke about women, and then they cut to a woman panelist laughing, and they're like, "Yeah, it's okay."
Yeah.
I was like, "Am I doing that?" But online, is this really? But then I thought, they're the only person who can give me dishonest opinion because they've been through it and they know what I'm trying and how I'm and they know me well enough to know that I'm friends with them, so I'm not anti-gay in any way. So
I've done with my gay stuff. I phoned Craig Hill, and I was like, "I've got this routine about gay people." He was like, "Are you really?" Phoning me, I was like, "Yeah, because I just want to make sure." And I went through, and he was like, "No, that's
I'd laugh at that." Yeah.
I'd laugh at that. And I'm like, "Good."
He didn't just say, "I'd laugh at that," because that's awkward.
Yeah. I was like, "Is this so ignorant?" He's like, "No, it's all good." And I was just like, "Thanks, Buffy," and hung up the phone.
You were talking about TV stuff,
yeah,
and how you got that quite early, and like you said, some other people might be more deserving or qualified or anything like that. I think every comedian I've spoken to has said that about their own TV appearance, where they've said, there's probably someone better. And it's just a thing we do because we all look at...
Every gig I've ever had, John Maloney could have done better.
Right, okay. but the thing is that... So I spoke to Adam Bloom recently.
Yeah.
And I asked him a question I'm going to ask you later, which is, what is the biggest problem with the industry and how would you solve it? And so think about an answer now. But for him, he said the biggest problem is that the industry seems to favour youth over experience. Because sort of the new, they take someone who's new, who's maybe got a competition credit or something, and then throw them out there and go, they're the new big thing. Whereas he was like, I'm way better now than I was 10 years ago, and I don't get the same opportunities as someone who maybe has just come through the Chortle New Act, for example, because I've already on the circuit. And I was thinking when you were saying that, were you at the time aware that when you were getting these spots that, you know, you might be getting them because they're sort of trying to, not diversify, but trying to keep a bit of variety to
the absolutely,
night.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And did that ever, like, throw you off?
No, that made me, that's what made me really work. Like, and I agree with what Bloomy said there, but then also, I think, and not in Bloom's case, because I think Adam is one of the best headliners, like, on the, so, I mean, I've not seen him, but if he's better than he was 2 years ago, last time I saw him live, he's amazing. Like,
he's not. Again, just saying flippant things.
Just because it's obviously not what you think.
Not true. No.
But I do think I've got some partially agree with it, but then I also think the newer generations that are coming through are working so hard. Like, not all of them, but like you. Sometimes, you know, I don't do Jonglers or Highlights gigs anymore, but they'll be like, oh, how are these young comics, you know, getting all this work? And I'm like, you've been doing the same 20 minutes for 4 years. That new comic that you're shitting on has written 3 shows in 3 years. Like, I'm doing my 8th solo show. This is my 8th hour in a row this year, and brand new every year. And so when how did you get that? I'm like, oh, because I work.
But here's the interesting thing. When I've spoken to most club owners, they say they want a mix of consistent people who have like a 20 spot, for example, that they know what they're going to get. So they know they can they know what material they're going to come down and do, that it's going to work. They can put them in every, you know, 6 to 8 months or whatever. And that means that they know on a bill, two of the acts definitely will nail. And then they can put someone else in the middle who's a new person or someone that they're trying out.
Yeah.
So I get it from the club's perspective and why maybe that person who's been going a little while has just that 20 minute for 4 years.
Yeah.
But I think it's, who is it? Phil Nichol does that a bit, where he does the circuit with like a set and then writes a show.
Yeah.
So I suppose it depends on why you're doing club stuff versus your show stuff.
Yeah. Phil Nichol is a great example. You want to talk about like in Attitude? There was one day when I was on this. I thought I was on the same bill with Phil Nichol, and I was on after him. And I'm like, I can't follow Phil Nichol.
I know. Really.
Fortunately, I wasn't. But yeah, he just goes, oh God, I can't. There's no way I could have like that.
Have you ever asked specifically to switch places with someone because you didn't want to?
No, but I no, because it's a proper pride thing. I'm like, no, I deserve to be in this green room because I had I felt out of place in green rooms for years and years until like maybe in the last 3 years. I remember I had a gig with Mark Nelson, who's been my friend since I started comedy, and Mark Nelson's one of my favourite working stand-ups. I think Mark Nelson is a better comedian than I am. He makes me laugh harder than I make myself laugh. And there was gigs where one, he was always the headliner, I was always support, and then one day it started switching when I was headlining, and it's because I had TV credits. It's because the audience knew me more than they knew him.
Interesting.
And so, I was just like, and I was like, what? I'm not, but I was just like, I've got to bring my A game now. I've got to justify this, because what would be worse if then 2 years after that, suddenly that switch went back?
Yeah. So if anything, the TV credits, although you know, provided you with a lot of stuff, they also provided you with that I've got to work now.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That the success I got young, really, I was like, you've got to maintain this, and you've
or
got
stop doing comedy completely.
Yeah. You've got to make sure that while you're on stage, those comics aren't backstage being like, how the fuck did he get this gig? You've got to make sure that so for me at least, it really made me work and go, right, okay, let's not give anyone the chance to question this.
Mm. I think what I like most about what you just said was a kind of shared ethos there, where I think new comics are working, but also they're working in a different way to comics that have maybe been doing it 5 to 10 years in the last 5 to 10 years, if that makes sense. Because the internet has become bigger, and I think a lot of acts that are maybe a slightly older demographic are either scared or shun doing something on social media. Mm. And as a result, for example, you're quite big on Twitter, for example, and you've got a bit of following on Facebook and obviously Muff for YouTube. And by doing that, you're obviously making connections with your audience throughout the year when you're maybe not even in the same country as them. Whereas, you know, some comedians who don't even think to engage or try and do any of that, they might not see that as part of their job in some ways, you know?
Well, there's some comics that are... I mean, I'm not very good at social media, really. I'm on it a lot, but I'm not as good a tweeter as Rhys James or Adam Hess. You want to talk about people who nail social media, like Rob Delaney, Catherine Ryan,
Gary Delaney.
Yeah, these comics, they're just so good in it, but I'm not good at writing jokes in 140 character format. And the same reason I wasn't good in panel shows. It's my jokes are bits and ideas and sort of concepts that require me just humming an eye and being like, is this,
but you still do it,
I mean, you want to talk, Chris Ramsey, I think, is, if you want to talk about someone who is the absolute king of how to do social media, I think Ramsey is up there. How he's able to I don't know how he does it, but the man, I mean, he's a great stand-up. He's got a phenomenal work ethic. And I know Ramsey for years and years was given such a hard time in the circuit, which was absolutely not deserved, because he worked his ass off And the reason people didn't like him was because he was good. He was good at self-promotion. Mm. And people were like, oh, look at him self-promoting. You're like, that's what Twitter's for. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, oh, he's just plugging a show every day, talking about how well his gig's going. You're like, he's not doing it for you. He's doing it for his art. You follow him.
Yeah.
Of course, as a comedian, you're like, I would never do that. And you're like, yeah, and you don't do it. And that's why he's bigger than you are.
Yeah. No, for me, this podcast, for example, I started it simply because I wanted to talk to some people in industry and no one was answering my emails. And I think we've all had that moment where we're like, I want to just ask some questions because no one, you know, like, I just didn't feel like there was any resource out there for me if I wanted to get booked somewhere or I wanted to find out what an agent's looking for or anything. You can't just email them and say, what are you looking for? Because they probably get that email 100 times a day or whatever. And so I thought, how can I talk to them? And then I sort of, I started writing a book about 2 years ago about how you, as comedians or as performers, should make stuff just because you want it there.
Yeah, that's what Muff was.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like, I went to a Christmas party a few weeks ago, and there was a comedian there who said to me, it's really inspiring that you did this and that you actually make stuff and you put it out there and stuff. And I was like, you could do it.
Yeah.
It was just, and they were like, no, I don't know where to find the time. I was like, well, you could leave now
and
on the train home.
And also, you're a comedian, you've got time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to edit this on the way home, and then I've got a gig in Kent, and I'm going to write my set on the way.
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing on the train? Are you watching Muff on the train? Like, not doing any. I mean, obviously you should, but sorry, I didn't mean to catch you while you were smoking.
<No. laughs>
but you get my point, though. It's like I figured I could spend 3 hours a day watching cats on YouTube. Or I could spend 3 hours a day editing a podcast and putting it out.
Yeah.
And I know which one I prefer. Well, the cats is the one I prefer.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But the point is that...
But I'm the comic you're talking about. I'm so lazy.
Okay.
I work so... I play FIFA all day. I just get stoned and watch Netflix and stuff. But just because... I just want to be a stand-up. Like...
How hard is it then? So... You tour, so you do your show every year in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
You then come down to the Soho usually, or you have.
No, this is my first time at Soho, in it, but I come. But I do the my year basically goes Fringe tour bin is the
right.
Is my sort of
And so how are you finding writing a new show and previewing it and doing spots? So because I mean I assume you don't do new material at clubs because that's suicide.
No, it's the only place I do new material.
Oh really?
I mean, obviously, I put it in with other stuff. I used to be a bit sort of cowardly with it, with like, I'd sandwich it between two bits that I knew worked. But then Louis C.K., I was heard in a podcast or an interview, was like, I always, wherever I'm most scared to put my weakest material is exactly where I put it.
Yeah.
Because that drives me to make it better. If I've got my weakest bit, I close the show with it because I'm like, this is such a weak closer. And then you just really work on it. And you work on it more. And I'm like, God damn, that is a good, terrifying way of doing things. But
no, it a year ago, I was on stage doing a new material night. And I listen back to every gig I do because I'm stupid like that.
No, you absolutely have
it,
to.
It's just mad. But I was listening back to it and I'd said something flippantly and it stuck with me for ages where I looked at my notes and I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And then they all went, no, go, you know, because they were with me. And I was like, no, I can't sell it. You're not going to buy it. It's not like that. And I remember thinking to myself, I always need to sell it.
Yeah.
Always need to sell it. I never tell them you can't. Even at this night where it's not the biggest, you know, thing or like the career break move. Because you don't know who's there.
Yeah, you don't know.
And you don't know who's there who knows someone who's there, if that makes sense. So I've always since then just gone, even if I'm not 100% sure of it, I'm going to go down guns blazing. Regardless of if it dies.
Yeah.
Because I'd rather know that I died.
Trying my hardest.
Yeah. So I believe in that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, you're absolutely correct. And I think I didn't for years listen back to my sets, and you have to. Because Stade's always been a fan of filming his sets and watching it back. And I'm like, why don't you just record it? And he's like, and he just went, Dano, I never realised how much my face did. I never realised that, you know, and he really studies his movements and you know, like how, you know, that turn there, if he did it 2 seconds later, the next day it got a bigger laugh, that eyebrow raise and that stuff. I mean, I still don't do it. I just don't film. And I find it so hard to watch myself. But listening to myself, I think, is as good as I can go at the moment.
Okay. And you mentioned that you, I don't want to say shunned panel shows, but it sounds like you've actively just been avoiding them?
Not just panel shows, but just like certain shows where I was just like, yeah, there's, you know, I mean, the money's okay, but I never got into this job to make money.
Right.
I didn't, and I've been lucky in my career that I am now at a stage. I'm now at a stage financially where I could make those artistic decisions to not do those shows because I didn't need the money. So I was,
okay.
Which is a very privileged position to be in, and I'm so glad I am, because I was like, oh, I don't have to do that show. I don't have to be happy and joyous and like, hey, I'm always on. I don't have to, because that's not who I am.
But so pre that,
mm-hmm.
when you were obviously coming through and your agent was going, oh, I've got you this great spot on.
Oh, she was.
Let's say Russell Howard, for example. Yeah. I mean,
well, that was stand up. So I was like, absolutely. Any show that's straight stand up, I'll happily do to an extent.
But in terms of when you're doing something like that show, or when you're doing any of those shows, first of all, do they pick your material on those shows? Because, you know, like you said, you're entering their house.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes, and I have a lot. There are some shows, stand-up shows, where if they don't let me do the stand-up that I want to do, where they're like, it needs to be cleaner than that, I go, if I go on stage, I was very scared. Like, when I did the Palladium, right, 7 p.m, I had to do clean material, and I'm just going to my age, I'm like, if I go out there doing clean material, like, really clean material, the only 5 minutes of my show, if I'm filtering through my hour of material and finding the 5 minute that is clean, the people that haven't seen me before are going to see that clean, and then they're going to come out and see the show about drugs and death and God, and they're going to walk out. I'm selling them a false thing. I'm selling them, and that's why I didn't want to do it. I don't do shows where I feel like I'm selling a false version of myself.
Yeah. Or false version of yourself on stage.
Yeah, false version. Yeah, yeah. Because then they're going to say, oh, that's what he does, and then I don't do that, and then they're going to be like, huh, like.
Yeah, I spoke to Nick Helm briefly a while ago, and he was saying Uncle, the show he did, was really bad for him because people came thinking he was that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then obviously he shouts at them. Obviously that's not what he does, but that's
so different. It's in your face rock and roll, and yeah. it's Nick is, again, one of the ones you just go, I'm not following Nick Helm. I don't want to do that. Like, that's a energy and a style that I can't match.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
But then again, I guess you have to follow those people. You're like, you've got to learn how to get an audience who've just gone through high energy and be like, right. So, because there are some... John Maloney is a perfect example. John Maloney can follow any comic.
Mm.
And within 2 seconds, he'll bring the audience. Being like, all right, you may have just seen, you know, Russell Kane, you know, doing this frantic, frenetic, da-da-da-da-da. And John will go, be like, no, back down to my level. And it is possible. And it's watching comics like that, you just go, ah, maybe I shouldn't be as scared.
Yeah.
Or as not willing to do that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I did a gig a couple of months ago, and a comedian went on before me, and I'm friends with this comedian, and they nailed it. Like, they did so, like, they had an applause break in the middle and then at the end, and I was like, I've got to go on now.
Yeah.
And like, the MC was like, are you going to be all right? Like, because you want me to do a bit in the middle and do that? I went, just bring me on.
Yeah.
Just bring, because at the moment I was like, if there was a break or something, you know, you'd be like, I'll take a minute and I'll do whatever. I just went on and I did, and I got invited back and stuff. And I remember when the promoter was like, you know, you did really well. I was like,
Much
better than any feeling you've ever had before, where you know that the person before you has done that well. So you've had to.
You've had to match. Yeah. It's the nice kick up of the arse I think a lot of us need.
Yeah, definitely. I know I would have liked to have, if I could have switched it around, but then I think, would I have?
Because it's not
going to make me better.
Yeah, and, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. These are quick fire questions, but you can take as long as you...
Go on.
That's okay. These are quick fire questions, but you take as long as you want to answer them. Ask every guest them, okay? What are the best books on stand-up writing comedy that you've ever read?
None.
Okay.
I think an important book to read, and it's just a great one, is I Killed is a book. A bunch of road comics from America got together and got all the other road comics who toured like during the 80s and 90s. We're talking like Chris Rock and Doug Stanhope and Jerry Seinfeld and stuff, just to tell their weirdest road stories and their deaths and their weird sort of sad things. It's just a really good book, and you just hear in reading about how much people you respect died on their fucking home and ate shit. was really good to read, because I was just like, because sometimes when you die, you just feel like, I'm the only one that's done this. You see all these other comedians that are amazing, you're just like, oh, they never die. And then you read and go, oh no, everyone does. Yeah. And
You sort of need to be reminded of that, because you only see their highlight reel otherwise. Mm. And it's why, slightly off topic, the DVD I just recorded, I did it in one take.
Yeah.
Because I got fed up of watching DVDs that are, you know, like four nights in a row.
Yeah, spliced together. Yeah, stuff.
And there's some bits of it that are not as good, and I've done better. But I'm like, I'm putting it up as it is.
Yeah.
Because I want it to be as a show would be,
rather
than that.
Yeah, you don't want to create that falseness.
Yeah, definitely. So I get that. That sounds like a good book. What's the best show you've ever seen?
Live.
Either live or on DVD?
Bull Burnham Watt.
Okay.
I think it's...
Why?
It's unapologetically intelligent. It's the old Bill Hicks mantra of play to the smartest person in the room. There's no compromise in it. It's smart on 1,000 different levels. It's talent on a whole different scale. Bull Burnham is the reason I will never be the best comedian my age. He's a month older than me, so for 1 month of the year I'm the best comedian my age, and then I turn his age.
Okay. What's the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you get over it?
Probably when I would see an audience and realize that they weren't going to like what I was doing, and I would do tamer or cleaner material. And I started writing with Tom Stade, and he would just, if you want, he's again unapologetic with the way he does his stand up. And just watching the way he just went, Dano, if they hate you, they're going to hate you. If they're not your audience, you'll find them next time. And I just kept writing material that made me laugh, and instead of what was the phrase that Kai Humphries came up with there? Good comedians can tailor their material to an audience, but great comedians can tailor their audience to their material.
Nice. I like that. What is the most interesting thing you do that nobody else sees? Has to be comedy related, not like wanking.
Okay.
Like,
I watch a lot of stand-up. Like, I don't... If you go into my phone, I have maybe two music albums and about 30 or 40 comedy albums.
What would be the one you're listening to most at the moment?
I love Pete Holmes' Nice Try, The Devil. It's what I've been listening to quite a bit. It's just such a ridiculous fucking show. And or podcasts, comedy podcasts. I know a lot of people don't. I love talking shop. I love talking about the way we do this and how it works. And I love listening to people talk about it. I find the whole business fucking fascinating. I really study. I'm obsessed with comedy. I've been a comedy fan since I was 5 years old, and I'm really, really into it. So just binge watching comedy, binge listening to comedy.
What podcasts other than that would you recommend? Other than this one, clearly.
Obviously, the Comic-Con podcast.
Stuart Goldsmith. Yep.
Pete Holmes is You Made It Weird.
Yep.
Bill Burr's Monday and Thursday morning podcast. Yep. I listen to religiously. Full Fop with Will Anderson and The Dollop, which is one I just started listening to recently, with Gareth Reynolds and Dave Anthony. I was just sat on train laughing like a psychopath yesterday. I must look so stupid. Just like gut laughing.
Yeah, I've had that.
Yeah.
I was listening to Rahel Estepa the other day. And
who?
Rahel Estepa? Richard Herring's Leicester Square.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I was listening to that on the train the other day, and I just found myself laughing, and I saw someone noticing that I was just laughing, and I was like, I don't give a shit. You don't know what I'm listening to right now. Like, it could be, I mean, yeah. So, yeah, I've had that. When you look back over your career, this is probably going to be that Jeffrey story again, but when you look back over your career, what memory makes you the most happy?
So maybe one of those sort of moments where there's been a few when I've had a gig and there's been comedians in the room and a lot of comedians in the room, and you have a good gig and you have and you hear the comedians' laughter, because the audience, don't get me wrong, the audience laughter is lovely and it's why we're in the business, but when you hear that second laugh from the left, it's such an some of the times I prefer that laugh, because I'm just like, they know what they're talking about.
Yep.
Like, they know comedy, and if I get that reaction, absolutely.
Yep.
Making comedians laugh with my stand up.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the best. Yep. What is the biggest problem in the comedy industry, and how would you go about solving it?
Well, I would say the people at the top who are in... It's hampering talent. It's not letting talent be talent. It's getting young or new comedians and using their naivety and their sort of promising them this big opportunity, but then making them compromise who they are. And they, and I think teaching them that they have to compromise in order to get anywhere. And you don't. It's much harder. It's way harder if you don't compromise. And there are a lot of people who don't compromise who won't make it. But I think just not letting talent be talent, telling talent what to do. And the way to do that is either every commission head and comedy head needs to leave or go to more comedy clubs, or just have a bit more, you know, balls or, you know, tits to just be like, yeah, fuck it, we find it funny. Yeah, we'll let you do you. Let comedians be comedians.
It's like Louis's sitcom. They just said, let him do it.
And well, because he turned up and he was like, I'll take a pay cut
massively,
and I get to make every artistic decision.
Yeah.
And obviously, Louis's not for everyone. Perfect example. More people know Phoenix Nights than they do Louis.
Yeah.
But we all prefer Louis.
Yeah. Well, all the comedians prefer
Louis. Yeah. But then again, like I said, I understand why they do it.
Yeah, it's
about advertising. It's about viewership.
If you had an extra hour in the day, how would you spend it?
Sleeping.
Do you know how many people say that? Like, I'm like, I get it. I would be really tired as well. But I don't know. I was expecting. I don't know why. At some point, I'm expecting one person to say, oh, "I'd climb Mount Everest." Or so. I know. I just
I just enjoy
everyone.
The extra hour of sleep.
Fair
and
enough.
Then probably have a better work ethic that day.
Yeah. Fair enough. What is the best bit of advice you've ever been given?
Don't ask the audience how they are.
Okay, as in you mean you'd come out and say...
I used to always, for years, be like, hey, how are we all doing? Are we well? Are we good? And stage was just like, why do you ask the audience how they're doing? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, Dan, you don't care. You're lying to... The first thing you do to your audience is lie when you come out and say, how are you doing? You don't give a fuck how they're doing. You care how they're going to be. And you tell them how they're going to be by doing what you do. And I haven't asked an audience since. Just like, come out and just go straight into the stand-up or...
So you go, hello, and then...
Not even hello.
Okay.
Just like...
Fair enough. I always used to avoid it. And then someone said to me, but how are supposed to feel like you're, you know, in the room with them and stuff?
Yeah, I mean,
and so I started doing it, but then I started sort of going, you know, I'm all right as well, by the way.
Yeah. I'm sort of right. Now I just come out and be like, thanks for coming, which I genuinely mean. Like, thanks for coming, but just sort of meander a bit and not come out punchline heavy. Not be terrified of that first laugh and how long it's going to take to get there.
Yeah.
Know that it's coming.
Yeah. What if you could give one bit of advice to a comedian who wants to make a career in this, what would it be?
Love it. Always love it. And the second you stop loving it, get fucked. Get out of the business. I don't like hearing comedians complaining about how much they hate comedy. There are enough comedians and there are a finite amount of gigs. If you're not enjoying it, get fucked. Give it to someone else who's got the drive. The second you stop loving this job, fuck off.
Cool. What is the biggest lesson you've learned in the last 12 months? It could be personal or comedy, this one.
That I am right most of the time. just that you don't... Just because you disagree with someone doesn't mean that it should affect your relationship in any way. Learn to... I've got people I disagree with, and it used to wind me up. I can't respect you if you believe that. And I'm just like, oh, why the fuck do I care? Mm. You're a person. Everyone's a human being.
Yeah.
Act as such.
Yeah, fair enough. If you could go back and give yourself one bit of advice before your first, let's say, the stand gig, what would it have been?
Start younger.
Okay.
I'm so happy I started when I was 17, because I love the fact that I'm 25, and... I've got 8 years under my belt of proper experience, but not as much as I'd love to be 25. I have 9 years under my belt, or 10 years under my belt. Because nobody remembers your first gigs. Like, my agent forced me, pretty much, to do my first Fringe show in 2019. I didn't want to do it. I wasn't ready for the Fringe. I wasn't ready to do it in an hour. And you know what? It was crap. Who remembers my first show? No one. Who remembers my second show? No one who remembers my third show. No one who remembers my fourth show. No one. But that's 4 years. That's 4 hour-long shows I did. Four different hours. And that experience is unquantifiably valuable.
Was that the same with TV then? Did they say, we want you to do a spot on whatever, like the road show or something? Yeah. And you were like, I'm not ready.
Oh, no, I was so ready for that. Like, I mean, they were like, do you have 10 minutes? I'm like, yeah, I've got a killer 10.
Well, no, it's not about, I mean, it's not just about having 10 minutes in that situation, because obviously you're going to have to, I mean, do you burn the material when you've been on TV? Because obviously
Sometimes, so
many people have seen it. I imagine that you can't just go to a club and then they'll go, oh, he's that guy, he only does that, I won't go and see him on
tour.
But
my material changes. I've done jokes on TV that when I do them live, they're so different because they, you know, jokes adapt and change as they go on. Never put a full stop on a joke. Never think a joke's done. Like, a joke is never done, because the second you get complacent in it is when you start getting bored of it. Also, a bit of advice, get bored of your material. Get bored of it.
Yeah.
Because the second you get bored of it, you're either going to put more work into it or you're going to bin it and get on. I get so bored of jokes after I've told them, like, after a sort of year or two. And it's great because it makes me do more. It makes me write more. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me, man.
That was Daniel. He is so much fun to talk to. I sort of had to find him around London because, as he said, he's not really a tourist, so we didn't really know where we were. We recorded this in the South Bank Centre, so there's a little bit of background noise here and there, but I think I've managed to get rid of most of it. And, well, at this stage, if you've listened this far, I'm presuming it was fine and you didn't have any issues hearing anything. If you'd like to find Daniel online, you can find his Twitter feed at Daniel_Sloss. If you'd like to tweet either of us a picture of a cock, feel free to do that. That would be amazing. And if you've skipped part of the podcast and you've come to this bit of the outro, that won't make any sense to you. Sorry, but that's your fault for skipping over it. You can also find his sitcom online at muffproductions.com. And if you would like to see him touring around, it's all on his website. Please do support him if you'd like to see him live. Other than that, if you would like to support this podcast, please do consider joining the Facebook group. It is called RC Industry Podcast, and it is on Facebook, of course. Consider leaving... I'm really running out of ways to say these things. Right, like, it's I've done it 46 times now, so here are the things. Right, you can join the Facebook group, you can leave us a review in iTunes, you can become a patron on patreon.com, you can leave me a one-off donation, and you can buy my book. Right, pick one or two of those things and please do them, because they all help in different ways. Also, you can share links. I keep forgetting them. Should have made a list. You do one or two of those things, please. Really, it would really help out the project. If you are loving this project as much as I am and you think there's some value to it, recommend it to a friend. Please consider donating some money, because it really helps me have a budget for the future. Don't donate if you don't have money, because I don't want anyone else going into debt for this than me. So if you can't afford it, don't do it. But if you can afford 80p an episode, that'd be great. If you can afford to buy my book for £5, that'd be great. Whatever you want to do to support, that'd be great. Speak to you soon. See you in about 10 days. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.